Hey there, this is Virginia Prescott with producer Sarah Plourd.
Shh.
What? I mean, what?
We're having a secret drive.
Got it. If you love the show, consider making a small donation to the station where we make it, and we will send you some secret swag.
What is it?
I can't tell. It's a secret.
All right. Go to nhpr.org/support and chip in to get yours.
We're trying to keep things quiet, but we hope that you will make some noise for word of mouth.
The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. From unanswered Facebook messages to commercials at the gas pump to the smartphones vibrating in our pockets, outside forces are constantly vying for our attention. In his book, The World Beyond Your Head, Matthew Crawford ponders distraction in the 21st century and ways to reclaim our focus. Matthew Crawford is a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture and a motorcycle mechanic at the Reclaimed Vehicle Fabrication Lab. I spoke with him when the book was first released. It's now out on paperback. And Matthew Crawford, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So it seems like this is, you know, an argument that we've heard before. First it was, and this is quite a while ago now, radio is rotting our brains. Then it was TV is rotting our brains. Now people are saying the same sorts of things about social media. Do you think we are more distracted than we have been before?
Well, you're right. It's an old complaint. In fact, it was over 100 years ago that a German sociologist referred to what he called the intensification of nervous stimulation that he associated with the city environment. But yeah, so maybe this has been an ongoing thing, and I tend to think it's actually not so much the technology itself that's the source of this as the intention behind it. One way this really kind of came into focus for me was that when I was in the grocery store and I swiped my bank card to pay for groceries, and so you know how you enter your PIN code and
yeah,
then
sure.
It's a pause, and then you confirm the amount. And so there's these little pauses. And during those pauses, I was shown advertisements.
Wow.
Because some genius figured out that a person in that situation is a captive audience. And so it just kind of, I started to see this everywhere, that there's this really aggressive effort to monetize our attention. And I think we're not yet very articulate about making a claim for our attention on our own behalf and regarding it as a resource. I guess speaking up for or against the kind of appropriations of our attention that have become pervasive.
Well, you said that it's not that technology is to blame. So what role do you think technology does play, and especially the stuff that people tend to complain about, social media, or smartphones?
Well, part of it is that a lot of this stuff seems to be engineered to tap into sort of mental appetites that are hardwired. So just as food engineers figured out how to create hyper-palatable foods by manipulating levels of salt and fat and sugar, some of these digital media seem to do something similar in that they're tapping into these hardwired appetites. So you might consider distractibility as the mental equivalent of obesity in terms of its kind of widespread societal effect.
You know, I wonder how much, we are sort of to blame. I don't mean to keep throwing around the blame word as though this is what we're trying to do, but I was thinking, you know, it seems that we seek out distraction on some level. You know, I will sometimes do everything in my power to remove distractions when I'm working on a project, and yet I will find some way, you know, whether it's spinning a quarter on the desk in front of me, to keep myself from doing what I'm trying to do sometimes.
I think that's a really important point. It's not just that we have these unwanted intrusions. There's also diversions that we willingly invite into our lives, whether it's Candy Crush on your phone or porn or whatever it might be. And sometimes we find these no less disturbing than the intrusions because they seem to crowd out other forms of engagement with our surroundings and with other people. But as you said, on this front, there seems to be nobody to blame but ourselves. So what you find instead is people reaching for this notions of self-control. And it seems like strategies for self-regulation are having a renaissance right now that's
right.
kind of unprecedented. It's not something we associate with consumer capitalism. It sounds like somebody, you know, more in a monastery. But I think we're not going to be able to either you know, liberate or self-regulate our way out of mental fragmentation. I think the remedy, rather, is to become absorbed in some worthy object that has intrinsic appeal and that elicits your involvement in such a way that your mental energies are kind of gathered to a point. And once that's underway, I find it feels more like abandon than self-control. I think the language of eroticism is maybe better suited for parsing it than is the language of asceticism.
I'm speaking with Matthew Crawford. He's author of a new book, The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction. And what you're talking about sort of reminds me of this concept of flow, which people have talked about, you know, when you're really into something to the point where everything sort of just fades away. And in your book, you examine the workflow and attention spans of people doing a few different professions. They don't sound connected necessarily. You talk about short order cooks, bartenders, glass blowers. What are they doing right, do you think?
Yeah, so consider a bartender. So he gets an order, let's say it's a house of glass red, a mojito, a martini up, and whatever, a beer. So what does he do? He lays out the different kinds of glasses that each of those different drinks requires on the bar, and announce other orders are coming in at the same time, and he lays out more glasses sort of next to those. And what that means is that both the content of those orders and their sequence is visible at a glance. It's out there in the world, which is good because there's only so much room in his head. So this is just one example of the way that we can recruit our surroundings to sort of scaffold and support our cognitive abilities rather than tax them unnecessarily.
So how do you think that translates to, you know, sort of off-the-job life? I mean, for a lot of these people, you know, the jobs may be rewarding. Sometimes they're not. But those are jobs. And often when I think of distraction, I think of our time away. It's, you know, it's our recreation time that sometimes we're not using to the fullest.
Yeah, I certainly feel like that. So,
okay, so I'm glad you share this pain,
yeah.
At least a little bit.
Absolutely. I don't offer myself as a guru on this stuff. I'm just trying to think through the problem. So one example is, you know, I open a challenging book and I try to read it. And I find that after about a page, I'm drumming my fingers on the table and I'm getting kind of antsy. And then I realize, oh, it's Tuesday night. My favorite TV show is on. And so I turn it on and who knows, maybe this is for the best because the next day I have some basis for chit-chat with other people. I'm not a freak. In grad school, I felt sort of disconnected from the surrounding culture because I was so intensely focused on what I was doing.
Yeah.
And whereas now I like to think I'm kind of hip. But here's the thing. So if I had gotten absorbed in, say, Aristotle last night, my head would still be turning in these spirals of untimely thoughts that would sound strange to my acquaintances. And if my experience is typical, it means that we're becoming more similar to one another. I think there's a large cultural consequence to our ability to concentrate on things that aren't immediately engaging or lack of that ability, and that is the persistence of intellectual diversity. So I think to insist on the importance of trained powers of concentration is to recognize that independence of thought is a fragile thing and requires certain conditions.
So I guess the idea is a lot of the distractions that we face in life are bringing us to some sort of center, to some sort of sameness?
I think so. I think there's a kind of washing out of human difference because it's in sort of throwing yourself into these demanding practices that aren't immediately engaging that people cultivate their highest powers. Maybe it's practicing the piano. You have to do a lot of mindless repetition of scales to get to the point where you're you know, expressing yourself on the piano. And the problem is that we're constantly being addressed with these kind of hyper-palatable mental stimuli that make it hard to do that. So there does seem to be a kind of asceticism that's required to get it off the ground, that is, you're becoming skilled in some demanding practice.
Well, you know, one of the parts of your book you talk about is sort of the visual distraction. There's a lot on ads. You know, it's one thing when it's at your home. What do you do when it's in your face? What do you do when you're out, you know, at the grocery store and you're faced by an ad as you're paying for your groceries? What can you do in that situation?
Well, there's not a whole lot. The cognitive psychologists talk about the orienting response, which is so an animal turns its face and eyes toward the new thing, that whatever appears in your visual field. And this is important in a world of predators, right? It's an important evolutionary adaptation.
Sure.
Well, if you're at the airport with the, TV screens everywhere, there's something new about once every second. And speaking of the airport, there was one time I was, the bottoms of those bins that you place your items in for security screening are now papered with ads.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, you haven't noticed
that? I haven't
flown
in a couple of years, so.
So one time, I had a flash memory stick in there that was very important. I had a talk on there I was going to have to give in a few hours. Well, and it's about the size of a lipstick, right?
Yeah.
So the bottom of the bin was papered with an ad for lipstick. So there's all these lipsticks, fanned out, and I very nearly missed my my flash memory thing. And so it just made me think, who decided to pimp out the security trades with these ads? Like, public space has been just auctioned off in this way. And let me give you another example. I was at the 30th Street station in Pennsylvania. It's this beautiful old train station. But you could see that it was beautiful only by trying to peer around or through these swimming pool-sized banner ads that were hanging up. All these banner ads were for a single enterprise. Apparently, this is called the Station Domination Campaign. So on this occasion, it was for some resort in the Bahamas. And what it felt like is that I was in a place that was no longer really a place. It was a mere surface on which to display enticements to be somewhere else. And it made me think, doesn't Philadelphia have any pride? Because it really did feel like a public patrimony had simply been sold off. And I think this is connected to a wider sense that politics has been captured by narrow interests that are often commercial in nature. And the very idea of the public is somehow at risk.
Well, Matthew Crawford, it was a pleasure and a relief to be able to pay attention to your book and have this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Matthew Crawford is senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies in Culture and author of the book, The World Beyond Your Head, on becoming an individual in an age of distraction, which is now out on paperback. In the early days of the space program, hotshot pilots were being recruited to become astronauts. Families watched in awe as husbands and fathers and brothers rocketed towards the moon in teeny little capsules. Nate DeMeo from the podcast The Memory Palace brings us the story of one of those astronauts and his family.
Charles Duke was 25 that spring when man first went to space. He was 26 when he met Dottie. He was on leave from the Air Force at MIT. He went there to get his degree in aeronautics and found out they also had something called astronautics. And it sounded cool. And so he did that too. Dottie was a secretary at Harvard Business School. They were both from the South. And they fell in love and complained together about the winter and were married in the spring. He got his master's, got into test pilot school at Edwards Air Force Base in California. Dottie liked the sound of California. Didn't think of the desert when she thought of California, though. Soon her husband was never around, and her days were all heat and dust and dashed dreams. Charlie was 29 when their first son was born, and when he saw this thing in the Sunday LA Times, front page, said NASA was looking for more astronauts for the Apollo program, for the moon. And that sounded cool. Sounded cooler to Dottie who thought lugging a baby around Houston would be an upgrade over the Mojave Desert. Charlie was 31 when their second son was born. And Charlie was never around. He was training to be an astronaut. He loved all of it. Loved learning. Loved the long hours, the weeks away, studying geology in Oregon and Hawaii and Iceland and Alaska, jungle survival in Panama, learning how to troubleshoot the far ultraviolet spectrograph, how to perform a translunar injection, while his sons were learning to walk, how to make sure their lowercase j's dip beneath the line, like a fish hook, while his wife was learning to do everything, everything at the house, because her husband was never around, because her husband was an astronaut. Charlie Duke was 33 that summer when man first went to the moon. He was in mission control. His South Carolina lilt was the voice of Houston.
Okay, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now.
As men he knew, co-workers, buddies, bounded on the moon.
That's one small step for man.
That was how things went for astronauts. You were assigned a mission and a role, and it meant that one man talked into a microphone while another walked on the moon. It meant that some families got the cover of Life magazine, got to meet the president, got that at least, in exchange for being without their father, their husband, for days and weeks at a time. Days and weeks that amounted to years. Dottie was in her early 30s when she started searching for something of her own, some sort of meaning outside of her marriage, in work, in smoking weed, and flirting with other men. She was a travel agent for a while. She liked that. She was good at that. Took trips to London, Africa even. But it was lonely, and there was a home to keep, and kids who needed help getting the chain back on their bike, finding the stuffed animal that got tangled up in the covers. And there was a husband who dreamt of the moon. Charlie Duke was 34 when he knew he was going. He was back up in Apollo 13. That meant he would pilot the landing module on Apollo 16. And that meant the moon. He was 36 when his turn came around. And his sons were old enough to notice that their dad was never around. And had seen enough rockets lift off. Seen enough smoke and fire. And fathers and capsules catching the light as they shrank in the distance and disappeared into the black they were told lay just beyond the blue sky. To know to be scared. And so Charlie said he would take them with him. And so they got dressed for a family photograph. Charlie and Dottie sit on a bench in the lawn. He's in a yellow button-down. His pants match his tie. They're both that color that Crayola calls burnt sienna. She is in a seafoam green pantsuit and a blue cravat. It's 1972. And there are the boys. Big smiles. Who knows how many takes it took to get those smiles. The oldest, Charles, like his dad and his grandfather, is 7 years old, a big boy, hands in his pockets, standing tall in front. The youngest, 5-year-old Thomas, leans on both his parents. One hand's on his dad's thigh, one's on his mom's. Who knows how much longer he'll still reach for them like that at a moment like this. There in the snapshot. Charlie was 36 years, 6 months old, when he spent 71 hours on the moon. He collected rocks. That was the bulk of the mission of Apollo 16, learning about the moon. And that's basically what there is to learn about the moon, its composition and origins. That and what it feels like to be there, to leap 4 feet off the ground like it was nothing, to see the Earth moon-sized. At one point, Charlie asked his partner, John Young, the Neil Armstrong to his Buzz, or Buzz to his Neil, depending, how long he figured their footprints would be there on the surface. With no wind, no weather. Young thought about it. Factored in all the things he knew about the moon, and he knew lots about the moon. And figured 4 billion years. 71 hours out of a life, then 36 years and 6 months long. Now 80 and change. After all those hours in the classroom, in the simulator, in the field, in the office, in line at the cafeteria, away from his family. And in one of those hours, 240,000 nautical miles from home, one of the last hours on his business trip to the moon, Charlie took that family photo, wrapped in clear plastic, bent a little bit from the journey, and placed it in the dust near the lip of a crater. He liked the idea that someone would find it someday, probably pretty soon. Maybe he'd even come back for it. Maybe on one of the next missions. Maybe one of the scientists on the moon base they hoped to build in the 80s would find it. Maybe a colonist. Maybe one of his own sons on some vacation someday. He didn't know then that he wasn't going back to the moon. He didn't know then that we don't go to the moon anymore. But he liked the idea that his family was there, where they are still, and will be for something close to forever. A snapshot. Two boys, a man, a woman, a moment in their lives.
That was Nate DeMeo from the podcast The Memory Palace. Coming up, the fastest rapper on Broadway, a podcast that will totally freak you out, and Jimmy Carter's campaign song. All part of the next installment of Word of Mouth's monthly playlist of online ephemera, Overheard. So stay tuned. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. It's time for our monthly installment of Overheard, where the staff shares bits of lost sound available for anybody to listen to online. We taped this conversation last week while Virginia was here. Also in the studio were producers Molly Donahue, Maureen McMurray, Logan Shannon, and the newest addition to our team.
Jimmy Gutierrez has joined our creative production team and is with us. And as he's hazing, we're going to ask him to come up with some sound for our Overheard segment. Jimmy, you ready to go?
I am. I just feel like what I picked out should probably come with a trigger warning. So,
way to start. Controversy. Can you give us any context or do we just have to hear it?
Okay. Through the moving process of coming out here, we inherited my in-law's record collection. And within that, I mean, there's a lot of goodies. And I found this one record that blew me away, and it just disturbed me by the album art. I browsed the playlist in the back, and I think we can play it, and then maybe I can give context on what it is.
Okay, let's hear
from
it.
There. So that's little Marcy. So I found the album, and it was this little puppet. And it's a ventriloquist. It's a woman named Marcy Tigner. She did Christian children's music for 3 decades. So Allie, my wife, didn't want to hear it. And what I would do is...
So you brought it to us?
I brought it to you guys, but I'll hide the album in places she can find around the apartment. So
wait, just to be clear, that's an adult ventriloquist doing a kid's voice?
Correct.
That is so scary.
Okay, now who wants to follow the devil?
My clip is kind of scary, too.
Okay, Maureen, let's have it.
Okay, so my pick is from a podcast. As you know, there's a podcast on NHPR called Outside In. Well, there's also another podcast just called Outside. It's from Outside Magazine. And they recently did, their first season was all about the science of survival. And for the first episode, it was all about how to survive freezing to death. It's not a story about someone else. They actually tried to make the listener feel like he or she is freezing to death. The way that they set the story is it's a man who's on his way to a party and his Jeep spins off the road. He gets lost. And it's just this series of kind of bad decisions that just snowball and escalate into the point that he hypothermia starts to set in. But let's hear it.
By the time you push off downhill, your muscles have cooled and tightened so dramatically that they no longer contract easily. And once contracted, they won't relax. You're locked into an ungainly, spread-armed, weak-kneed snowplow. Moments later, your skis catch on a buried log. The crash leaves your ankle burning in a way you know is bad. You've also lost your hat and a glove. Scratchy snow is packed down your shirt. Meltwater trickles down your neck and spine, joined soon by a thin line of blood from a small cut on your head.
Boy, this guy is not catching a break.
Your heat begins to drain away, and you're becoming too weary to feel any urgency. You decide to have a short rest. An hour passes. You barely notice. At one point, a stray thought says you should start being scared. But fear is a concept that floats somewhere beyond your immediate reach, like that numb hand lying naked in the snow.
It's a really interesting use of audio. Right?
Yeah, and you really, when I was listening to it, a lot of people said that they actually had to turn it off because it was too vivid, because you feel it. You get that panicked feeling and just an incredible piece, but you also learn a lot about what happens to the brain and the body when your core temperature drops. So I really recommend that people listen to it. It's not, you know, a leisurely Sunday drive listening, but it's just an incredible series of podcasts that Outside Magazine is doing.
Kind of reminds me of that Jack London story.
It's To Build a Fire, actually.
Yeah, that's it. Remembering my high school English class days.
Okay, does anyone have anything cheery?
Sorry.
I have something kind of fun.
Okay. What do you got, Molly?
Well, so a couple weeks ago, I was trying to find music to put on the show. And I
the
really
source
wanted,
of so many of our
so many things. And I wanted to use Riot Girl music. Surprisingly, there is very few options for Riot Girl instrumentals. So I didn't end up using it, but this is something I came across. It's from a band called Taco Cat. They just put out a new album, Lost Time, and this is the first song, Dana Catherine Scully. And I'm going to make all of you listen to it because I couldn't put it on the show.
There may be people who don't know who Scully is.
Scully is from The X-Files, Gillian Anderson, and she just threw her hat in for the new Lady Bond. So you should go listen to more Taco Cat.
I love it.
Logan?
Well, I could move on to something else, which, as many of you know, I am moderately to severely obsessed with Hamilton.
The historic figure or the musical?
The musical. And also sort of the historic figure by default, but... So what I want to play for you guys today is a little clip from a song called Guns and Ships, which features David Diggs as Marquis de Lafayette. Now, David Diggs is a very interesting character. He is a rapper. He has his own band called Clipping. But if I we were going to play a little bit from Guns and Ships so you can sort of see what Lafayette is like in the show.
Yo, turns out we have a secret weapon, an immigrant you know and love who's unafraid to step in. He's constantly confusing, confounding the British henchmen. Everyone give it up for America's favorite fighting Frenchman. I'm taking this horse by the reins, making red coats weathered with bloodstains. Feel I'm never gonna stop until I make a drop, I burn them up and scatter the remains down. Watch me engaging them, escaping them, and raging them out. I go to France for more fun, I come back with more guns and ships.
And so can we just say that to every word of that song, Logan has been mouthing along, so well, she has memorized the entire thing.
I should point out that I cannot mouth along to David Diggs in this because he actually, he holds the record now for fastest rapper on Broadway. He says 19 words in 3 seconds.
Whoa!
So this was brought up recently on Jimmy Fallon because Jimmy Fallon's a huge fan of Hamilton. He had David Diggs on and he talked to him a little bit about being the fastest rapper on Broadway. And this was David Diggs sort of responded to that.
That's very fast. I mean, are you used to rapping that fast?
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's sort of, that's fast. It's not fast. It is absolutely fast. It's kind of, in the rap world, that's medium fast.
Really?
It's fast, but it's not the fastest. Is there a faster?
Like, could you, like, is that your, could you give us a taste of faster, or?
I can rap fast.
We always have, but I'm not going to rap. Please, no, please. All right. Do you need anything?
No, right?
All right, cool.
Y'all inspired. That was a clipping song, so I'll do another clipping song. This is from another clipping song called Taking Off. But ski mask on with a burner cell phone, Desert Eagle 50 cal imprint on the backbone. This one is not to be tested unless you got Smith & Wesson quick at your disposal, if not better to head back home. This is a business, a uniform isn't unusual if you make killing a job. Money is good when it's coming from behind prison walls to someone who need to get off. Plus about to be done 9 to 5 and there's time to be outside instead of sitting at a desk making calls. And for anyone to stay alive up in the jungle, you should figure out a way to carry no remorse at all. All day long, it is bombs over Baghdad, right in the backyard. No service, no draft, no reason to go out, but it's no reason to stay in when the roaches are already and your neighbors bumping black flag. Tired of living like this, but not ready to die because he isn't notorious yet. Everyone wants to be somebody known for doing something, be called glorious, yes. So we keep it pushing through the button, all the gunning down the people that he knew and loved, just ran out of time. And the mantra that is bumping on the walkman in the pocket, probably something that's synonymous to money on the mind, this action.
Come on, dude!
That's like no joke.
That's awesome.
So David Diggs, I'm a little obsessed with him. He's amazing. He's an amazing rapper. You got to check out Hamilton. So
I was actually awesome. Looking at, there was an ad, I think it was in the New Yorker for NYU, you know, sort of like, so they're selling New York University and it says, your ticket to Hamilton. Like that's the reason to go to NYU now, because you'll be in town and you might get a ticket
and
to Hamilton.
And you might get the lottery ticket.
Well, I have a Broadway musical related one, but it takes a little backstory.
We're all ears.
Okay. So the last time we did this, Overheard, we actually recorded it on April 21st. And I remember that because we got out and we found out that Prince had died. That was a deeply moving experience for a lot of people across the world, not just for me. Prince meant a lot to me. And that night, Minnesota Public Radio was streaming all Prince songs, you know, like all of his records, and then having people call in with their memories, and they were reporting out to people who were at Paisley Park. It was like the thing that radio does best, I think, bringing everyone together who are thinking about the same thing. So I really deliberated about doing something Prince-related because now it feels a little far behind us. But, you know, after Prince died, there was Bruce Springsteen did a tribute song and, you know, in concert, and LCD Sound System did one at Coachella. But this is a recording I found. This is from the Broadway cast of The Color Purple, led by Jennifer Hudson. After the show, you'll hear it. They said that they were going to do a little tribute to Prince. So let's hear.
And that means you too, as Prince would say. I know y'all know the song.
Thank you.
watching you groove out to that, Taylor.
Listen, this is good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, here's the interesting thing here. That person you're hearing singing, not Jennifer Hudson. That is her co-star, Cynthia Erivo. Yeah. The thing that I found so interesting about it is then Jennifer Hudson comes in and tries to sing her ass off, you know, like they're in a cutting contest on some level, which I thought is so appropriate for Prince because he was a really competitive guy. If you've ever seen that video of him at, I guess it's the Rock Music Hall of Fame.
You can hear that she's withholding the tears for the purpose of the performance, but like they're right there. They're right there.
Yeah. And when everyone sings, it was a moment. It was a moment when a lot of people were captivated by the life of just one person. So it's great to remember. What'd you get, Taylor?
Well, that would have been such a nice finish with the Prince thing. I'm going to bring it back to politics, which just feels so obnoxious now. But it's actually, so the root of this is that, you know, wherever you stand on the candidates and the issues, this election cycle, I think, has ground a lot of people down and just feels like it's painful, whether it's the news or just sort of the negative ads or negativity in general. I was looking for something. I don't remember what. I stumbled along an old campaign theme song for JFK in 1960. And it reminds me of a different time. And it made me wonder about these campaign songs and when we stopped doing them. So let me just play a little clip from this. And it's, you know, you'll totally get what I mean when I'm talking about it.
Kennedy. Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new? A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you,
it's strictly up to you.
Well, it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy.
It sounds like a Christmas special, right?
Yes.
And so I started looking to see, like, how long did we keep doing this? And there's one for President Nixon in 1972 when he was reelected, running against George McGovern. Yep.
Reaching out to find the way to make tomorrow a brighter day.
It's sort of like a really weird Coke commercial.
Yes.
So 70s.
Yeah.
The last one that I could find was Carter versus Ford in 1976. Carter's is very different sounding.
I heard a young man speaking out just the other day. I stopped just to listen to what he had to say. He spoke straight and simple. By that I was impressed, he said. Once and for all, why not the best? Said his name was Jimmy Carter, and he was running for president. And it laid out a plan of action, made a lot of sense.
So very, very straightforward. But so sadly, it seems like that might have been the last race in which candidates actually had campaign songs that were specifically written. After that, you get Reagan in the famous It's Morning in America ad. Uh-huh. And I don't know. I just kind of, I'm hoping that someone out there is going to like write a 1960s Christmas song version of, you know, Clinton, Trump, Sanders theme songs. It might just bring a little levity to this race, if you know what I mean.
And then make America great again. I mean, there's your title.
Yeah.
Okay, Taylor, since you're our songwriter of the pod, I think we're going to commission you to write some kind of campaign song.
We'll see what we can do. But in the meantime, we should have just finished with yours. So let's bring up Little Purple Rain.
Something both parties can get behind.
Yeah, you know, it's like you're going to church suddenly.
You can choose your friends, but you can't choose your family, or so the saying goes. So if given the opportunity, would you choose to spend less time with your family? A new study published in the Journal of Social Psychology and Personality Science looks into whether income can predict the frequency and types of social interactions. Emily Bianchi is co-author of this study and assistant professor of organization and management at Emory University. She sat down with Virginia Prescott.
Emily, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So can you give us a top line? What were the results of this study?
So what we found was that people who reside in households with greater household income tend to spend more time alone and less time with other people.
Can you quantify that a little? How much more, less time?
Sure. Well, we looked in two different contexts. So in the first study, we looked at the number of evenings people reported spending with their family, or social evenings, I should say, with their family and relatives, with their people in their community, their neighbors, and then finally with their friends. And what we found was that overall, the wealthier a household was, the less time they spent socializing overall. But we also found that people in wealthier households spent their social time slightly differently. They tended to invest more or spend more time with friends, kind of the most voluntary relationship that we examined, and less time with relatives and with neighbors.
So higher earners spending less time with their families and neighbors. Mm-hmm. What are some of the factors that might contribute to that?
Well, there's been a large body of research in social psychology, mainly experimental research in fairly controlled settings, which have shown that access to money tends to dampen people's interest in socializing and engaging with other people and tends to increase their preference in solitary activities. And so we wanted to see in this context whether similar effects would emerge in messier real-world surveys.
So off the bat, I'm thinking about a couple of maybe stereotypes that we have, mm-hmm. that low-income people, you know, they have a lot more sort of family ties. Maybe they're bound to their neighbors. You know, mm-hmm. they may be working two jobs. Does any of this has to do with convenience and the sort of mobility to be able to seek friends outside of one's immediate sphere?
So it might. I mean, we were able to control for things like the amount of time people spent working, and that didn't seem to be driving the effects. So I'm not sure we don't see the effect being driven by how much time people are working and whether lower income people are working more hours or, you know, double two jobs, as you said. Kind of one of the theories going on in our field right now is this idea that kind of one of the many functions of social relationships is to give and receive emotional and material support. And that when you have more money, it enables people to more easily satisfy kind of their basic needs without the help of others, right? Wealthier people can use money to solve a lot of challenges that poorer people can't, from things like help with last-minute childcare, help with small household repairs. And as a result, this is kind of the going theory of why they might spend less time investing in social relationships.
Right. They don't need their mother to babysit for them necessarily.
Exactly.
Would the results of this point to any disadvantages in lower income households beyond, you know, just being low income?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. In terms of, you know, at first glance, this seems to be costly to higher income people, because we know that social relationships and social connections promote mental and physical health, right? So to the extent that wealthier people are spending less time attending to these relationships, this could actually have negative implications for them. On the other hand, it's possible, you know, there's still a lot to learn about why wealthier people are spending less time with others. It could be that money enables wealthier people to limit contact with relatives with whom they have strained and difficult relationships. Mm. So they may have kind of the luxury of picking which relationships to attend to and focusing on the ones that are most supportive and satisfying, and that might be a luxury that lower-income people don't have.
What are you going to pick up next in your studies?
So next, we're really interested in looking at the quality of people's relationships, because I think that can help us tease apart some of these issues, these remaining issues, about whether this is really harmful to wealthier people or whether it is maybe an advantage because they are able to spend less time with people who they have historical conflicts with or who, add stress to their lives.
Emily Bianchi, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Emily Bianchi is Assistant Professor of Organization and Management at Emory University. She was speaking there with Virginia Prescott.